Welcome to the 28th episode of the JewishDrain.com podcast and video series. I'm your host, Rabbi Drew Kaplan, and I'm really excited for this episode. I hope you are too. If anybody of you listen out there to last week's episode, Beer in the Bible, featuring Professor Michael Homan, this week's episode is a great continuation because Professor Jenny Ebeling is joining us today in this episode on women as biblical breweresses, right? So beer didn't just happen, it had to get brewed during biblical times. And so women as those who made it happen, who brewed that beer, that's what this episode is all about. So here we go.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. So Professor Ebeling is the Associate Professor of Archaeology at the University of Evansville. And she is a former Fulbright Fellow. She's done lots of work in archaeology. And two books of hers that I want to highlight that are relevant to our conversation are the 2011 book, Household Archaeology in Ancient Israel, and the 2010 work, Women's Lives in Biblical Times. So if any of you are curious about those works, I'm going to include all of those in the link in links and descriptions and below, as well as what brought me to talk to Professor Ebeling and why she's on the show today. She co-authored an article with Professor Michael Homan, who we had on the show previously, about baking and brewing beer in the Israelite household, a study of women's cooking technology. So I'm super excited because building off of the conversation I had with Professor Homan about beer in the Bible, how did it get produced? How did you come upon this topic? I know the article came out in 2008, but it was originally presented as a paper in 2005. So how did you put it together? How did you
research it? Exactly how it came about, I don't remember. But, you know, I've known Michael Homan for a long time, and we had, you know, been together in Israel and Jordan in the past doing research at the same time. So we had, you know, kind of overlapping interests. And my specialty is ancient bread production. And he was interested in, he's been interested for a long time, but at that time he was getting more interested in writing about, you know, ancient beer production. And so since there's a lot of overlap there, we decided to join forces and specifically look at, you know, what we might contribute with regard to an understanding of women's roles in all of this.
Wow, that's really great. And prior to really your collaboration with Professor Homan in either the 20th, 19th, or previous centuries, had there been any work done on beer production in sort of a biblical time era?
Not so much. I mean, from what I know, I mean, not so much in terms of, like, you know, from archaeological remains. So, I mean, there had been, you know, of course, lots of publications, you know, speculating about different alcoholic beverages in the Hebrew Bible. There had been some evidence, especially in earlier periods in Israel, for beer production using more Egyptian methods. But from, you know, the Israelite period, from the Iron Age, there really wasn't a whole lot of attention to any kind of archaeological evidence that might inform on beer production during that time specifically.
I do have to mention something having nothing to do with your article, but the 2018 study done by Stanford University that found the Natufian beer evidence from like 13,000 years ago, right? Yeah. So that must be, I mean, that supports your work, that if there was beer production 13,000 years ago, and that was the same region roughly, right?
Yeah. So there's some, I mean, that research was at Rakefet Cave, and like in the Carmel. And so they were able to find, you know, some great evidence for, I believe, malting in some bedrock mortars, like mortars that are actually cut into the stone, that apparently were used for brewing long before the domestication of barley and wheat, which is really cool. So, I mean, it shows that people were actually, like, you know, fermenting wild grains much earlier than anyone suspected.
Wow, that's really incredible. Yeah. And so aside from the 2018 study was done more than a decade after your work here with Professor Homan. And so it's a really awesome pioneering work. What was the reception like on your, either the paper itself or the article that was published subsequently?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's some people who've reached out to us over the years and some scholars who've gotten interested in this. The most recent thing I can think of that sort of helps support some of what we were talking about is a study that just came out in 2019 of, as you're surely familiar with, about some Israeli researchers. I mean, starting with a couple of biologists at Hebrew U who were taking samples of yeast from vessels from different periods and replicating ancient alcoholic beverages. So a couple of those examples were Iron Age vessels, including these beer jugs, you know, that we've been saying and others have been saying were likely used for drinking beer in ancient Israel. And so it looks like at least two of them proved, you know, to actually have the remains of yeast that could actually be extracted and studied and even replicated. Not replicated, actually used to create, from what I understand, a drinkable beverage. I don't think it's definitive that it was straight cereal-based beverages because of the issues with, you know, kind of the additions of fruits and other things to alcoholic beverages. It's hard to kind of, you know, define a clear-cut fruit, especially grape-based wine versus, you know, a kind of a barley-based beer that
exists. Yeah, one of Professor Homan's articles talked about would throw in dates, they would throw in honey and other various fermentables to add to their drinks. Yeah.
Yeah.
In your findings, one of the things that really was really neat was women leveraging bread production for power within the domestic sphere, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that my colleague Carol Myers at Duke University, who's professor emerita now, has written about quite a bit, about, you know, looking especially early in the Israelite period, at the Iron Age one, at evidence for women's control over, like, household food and drink production, and then how that, you know, led them to have more power and decision-making within the household context. So she relates bread and beer production directly to that, especially, again, early on in the Iron Age one.
That's really cool. So they could have, beer was there. It was what they were using. And I know something that came up in your article was the similarities of what was used for bread was also used for beer production. And so maybe that's what people may have overlooked it in the 19th and 20th centuries in their archaeological research, right? Whereas wine, it's a lot easier to tell, oh, that's wine remnant versus, well, that could have been beer, that could have been bread, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it's a couple of things, I think. I mean, one is that the archaeological remains for bread production have been understudied. So I argue a little bit in that article, but elsewhere as well, that, I mean, this is partly due to the fact that it's the physical remains of these sort of mundane everyday life activities that are really strongly associated with women. So, you know, previous generations of archaeologists just weren't interested. Luckily, however, they preserve really well. I mean, because we're talking about stone artifacts, you know, that we have by the, you know, thousand at archaeological sites, as well as, you know, clay ovens and other cooking installations that often preserve pretty well, you know, as well. So, I mean, that's part of the issue, is that these things haven't really been looked at very carefully until pretty recently. And so since that's bread production, and we know that beer is sort of an offshoot of bread production, then, you know, kind of unfortunately, you know, the result is that beer has been overlooked as well, because the technology for beer production has not really been a focus of study.
That's really fascinating. And can you share with us which specific items you found the archaeological remains that were used for beer production?
Yeah. So in ancient Israel, this would be primarily stone tools that were used to process grain, so barley and wheat primarily. And so these are like flat kind of grinding slabs or kerns or matates, you know, kind of using the New World term. And then, you know, some sort of upper grinding stone or hand stone would be used to grind, literally kind of back and forth like this. So this was long before the invention of other methods of grinding that would have led to greater efficiency, like the kind of more rotary, you know, grinding stones that we know from later times. So we have these things, you know, literally thousands of them from archaeological sites that are found sometimes whole and in context in situ, and then more often than not, often in, you know, in fragments. So those are the best, I guess, you know, archaeological remnants of bread production generally. And then if we're talking about having to, you know, cook and, you know, bake these things, either bread intended to be brewed or bread that was going to be consumed as bread or other baked goods, then ovens, tanors, sort of these upright clay ovens are ubiquitous. I mean, so they're found in archaeological houses, in courtyards, all over the place. So, I mean, we just have lots and lots of evidence of these activities happening in ancient Israelite sites. And so those far outnumber, like, the more specialized kind of equipment that Dr. Homan probably talked a bit about, you know, that seemed to evidence beer production specifically, like fermentation stoppers and these straw tip strainers and other things. So we do have those, but in relatively small numbers, whereas grinding stones and ovens, you know, we have by the score. So yeah, we have lots of evidence for those things.
That's really incredible. I Professor Homan also mentioned that there were certain items that there was kind of a debate on, and it was somewhat of a Rorschach test of whether it could have been perceived as for brewing purposes or maybe for like a weaving loom, for instance.
Right.
Have you encountered much of debate around these things?
Yeah.
Is beer more of a contested site than necessarily bread making is?
Yes. I mean, I think for the reasons that Professor Homan has written about, and we mentioned in the article that, you know, there's been this sort of tradition within biblical studies and even archaeology, you know, going back a century, you know, of against beer, you know, that wine was the alcoholic drink that the Israelites made and consumed and exported and all this. And beer just simply wasn't drunk. Or if it was, you know, consumed by Philistines, you know, with their Philistine jugs. So, I mean, that's part of the problem is that I think there's just this, bias against beer that you can see through the scholarship, you know, that doesn't seem to be borne out by the archaeological evidence. And I mean, in terms of the weights, I think different people have different interpretations of those things. And the best evidence that we have would be ones that are actually found in the context of sitting on a jar or within a jar, you know, that has the remains of barley or other cereals associated with it, which there are several examples of. But, these are things that are sort of accidental, you know, kinds of finds that they're not something that you would expect to find in most sites. So, yeah, I mean, there's just not a whole lot of direct evidence for beer, and there's a whole lot of direct evidence for wine, in contrast, as you know. So, I mean, it's sort of been just a scholarly preference to study wine over beer.
Hey there, I hope you've been enjoying this episode so far. I wanted to let you know there's still much more of this episode, which is great. And later on in this episode, I'm going to give you a sneak peek into next week's episode.
All right, taking a step back, can you contextualize for us? So clearly bread making and beer making were not the only things that Israelite women did. So can you provide us a broader sense of their lives, of women in the Israelite period, what they did?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, so a lot of what we know, I mean, comes from multiple sources. So of course we have biblical evidence and then textual and artistic sources from neighboring cultures, from contemporary neighboring cultures, as well as earlier. So, you know, one thing that seems to be potentially very useful, but also problematic, is our tendency to invoke like Egyptian tomb paintings for trying to explain ancient food and drink technologies, when those can be useful. But, you know, we're talking about things that are coming from earlier times and from a very different culture. So we have to do that carefully. And then, of course, the textual evidence also has to be used carefully, because we have to consider, you know, who the texts were written for and by, the intended audience, the time period. The fact that women's voices aren't represented in those texts is also a problem. So then it often really comes down to the archaeology and interpreting it. And so we interpret the finds, you know, that come out of the ground using those sources, as well as ethnographic sources, and in the case of ancient technologies, experiments. So, you know, the kind of replicative experiments that people have done, I've done a little bit myself, but they've been mostly failures, like in trying to reconstruct ovens, you know, making pottery using ancient techniques, brewing beer, as was done recently in this study in Israel on the East, is really, really useful, because it provides insights into those kinds of activities that would have been part of women's daily lives. So in addition to food,
How often are those experiments done using the exact same materials?
My feeling is that, you know, people are doing it and all the time. I mean, I've had my undergraduate students do some of these as part of a course on ancient food and drink technology here. In Israel, you know, there are folks in different programs and, you know, for courses or for MA theses and such, you know, have been doing some of these kind of experimental studies. And then different programs around the world, you know, are getting more interested in archaeological experiments. So there's, you hear in, you know, reports of and read articles about these things, you know, every now and again. I mean, blog posts, you know, also is another way that people kind of get the word out about this kind of work. Often it's the kind of thing that people are also doing as part of excavations in Israel, you know, like it's kind of part of the curriculum, you know, students are involved in, you know, replicating an ancient oven or something like that and firing it up and see if they can, they make bread in a traditional way. Which is kind of fun because it's a hands-on thing, but also you do get some insights into, you know, how difficult these kinds of things were in antiquity and, you know, those sorts of things. It brings you a little closer to the reality of their existence, I guess, how hard it was, you know, how hard that was. So And I've done a little bit of this myself. I did an ethnographic project in Jordan some years ago, where I actually, you know, went around and studied women who were still making traditional bread ovens in communities in northern Jordan. And you know, then I replicated one here at home. And like I said, it was a failure, but at least in that sense, I learned, you know, so that I could do it again. So ethnography really informs a lot of my understanding of women's traditional activities, especially those related to food and drink production, because that's often, you know, where our insights are coming from when we try to interpret archaeological remains. Since they're not labeled, you know, they don't, you know, speak for themselves. And then the texts and art can be problematic to use as a source. So I think food and drink technology, food and drink preparation was something that occupied women in ancient Israel for hours every day. Wow. That's the big kind of time suck activity. And then another one traditionally has been believed to be textile production. So spinning, weaving, that kind of thing. And again, this is something that we know about cross-culturally, you know, in terms of, you know, ancient Mediterranean civilizations, that this is something that women are very closely associated with. And certainly the biblical texts bear that out as well. All the kind of normal things, kind of family, you know, taking care of children, taking care of the elderly and the sick, would have been, you know, probably occupying women on a daily basis more so than most men. Mm-hmm. Animals, you know, caring for animals, perhaps, you know, that were in the possession of a particular family, probably fell to women often. And, you know, everything else basically you can imagine women were involved with. It just seems like these kind of provisioning for the family on a daily basis, especially food, drink, and clothing, seems to be the dominant activities. Wow. At least the dominant activities we can see archaeologically.
Yeah, that's great.
I mean, there's a lot more going on that we just don't have hard evidence for because it doesn't survive.
Yeah, and that was something I found really fascinating in the article, that certain things, if they're made out of stone, they're going to last longer than wood, you know, wood-based. Yeah. Can I go in a totally different direction? You mentioned archaeology and women. Was there much of a focus in the 19th or 20th century on the place of women in archaeology and like what they were finding? What's sort of the history of that?
Yeah, I mean, there hasn't been a whole lot of interest, I think, in archaeologists until more recent decades in just even finding women in the past. I mean, kind of that first step.
Yeah.
Where we are now, I mean, there's a lot more, you know, a lot more people who are, of course, interested in the topic. And so, I mean, there's more, you know, sort of nuanced approaches to trying to not only find, but, you know, kind of look beyond that as well, gender relations and other things that archaeologists have been interested in other parts of the world for a while now. So, I mean, there's just, from what I can tell, I mean, much more interest now than there was, say, 50 years ago in this kind of topic. And this is also related to a focus on the small, more so than the kind of grand, royal, administrative, public, ritual kind of approaches to archaeological research that sort of dominated past generations. Meaning that, you know, a lot of archaeologists were focused on finding the biggest and the best and the earliest and, you know, direct evidence for this king or this, you know, biblical event or something like that. And even though that's still an interest of some archaeologists, there are many more now who are focused more on household archaeology and looking at smaller sites and, you know, looking at these, you know, kind of more fine-tuned, I guess, archaeological projects with finer resolution so that you can really start to look at spaces that, you know, were used for specific activities that could be gendered spaces, you know, using even, you know, micro archaeological techniques, like looking at, you know, actual botanical remains of ancient food and drink in a way that, you know, just weren't sampled a few generations ago. I mean, that information's just not available. So now archaeology is just a lot slower and there's much more careful, you know, sampling going on so we can get a fuller picture from the remains that do exist. So this is great in, you know, doing archaeology now, but it's also difficult to go back and look at the work that was done, you know, by past archaeologists and try to extract that kind of information from their reports.
Oh, wow. It's a very different style of scholarship.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yep. And it's a lot less of just sort of generalizing about things and more really looking at specific case studies and looking at the nuances, which is really, it makes it all more difficult, but it's also a lot more interesting and it seems a lot more useful, you know, that kind of work.
I'm going to go in a totally different direction. So you mentioned earlier that there's a lot more archaeological evidence of wine production and consumption. Mm-hmm. So anything, were women involved with that? What have you researched or know about wine production?
Yeah, I mean, I've done a bit more research lately because I was the co-director of the excavations at Jezreel from 2012 to 2018. And one of our big finds from the Iron Age was a winery complex, which we published in a couple of places, but the kind of final reports is the final report's forthcoming in a journal, and it should be out in the next month. So it's in terms of trying to identify women's, I guess, roles in wine production. Again, the best sources we really have is coming from ethnography. Okay. So looking at, you know, late 19th, early 20th century ethnographic sources, whether it be accounts by local writers or, you know, anthropologists and others who are, you know, kind of writing about what they observed in the region, as well as photographs and other evidence. It, from what I can tell, during harvest season, at least, it's an all hands on deck kind of thing. Huh. Just like with the barley and grain, you know, the wheat harvest. I mean, it would have been, you know, every able-bodied person was out doing something related to these things. Huh. Since for wine production, you know, you're treading the grapes pretty much immediately after you're picking them, then it seems to me that probably a lot of the same people who are doing the picking are probably then engaged in wine production in the next steps. I mean, doing the treading and then, you know, any other activities that are involved with, you know, keeping up the wine vats and the treading floors. I mean, cleaning, eventually maybe, you know, the bottling these and moving them, you know, to kind of the caves and you know, cisterns and cooler places where the jars are going to sit for a while. So again, I mean, a lot of this is coming through ethnographic evidence that shows that women were doing these things in more recent times. I mean, we can't say that life was exactly the same way 3,000 years ago in the region, because it wasn't at all. But it's sort of these kind of patterns, I guess, of activity that suggests that that women were out there and involved when these harvest seasons came around, because there really wasn't any choice. I mean, they needed all the labor that they could probably get to do these things and accomplish them in the time, you know, a pretty short window. And so this is very different from beer, which, of course, you know, is made from stored barley, which can be made any time, or grain that can be made any time of year. I mean, wine production is a much more, I guess, specialized, focused kind of, you know, there's a narrow window, you know, to kind of make wine every year. It, you know, you can't keep the grapes for very long if that's the kind of wine you're making is primarily grapes. And, you know, beer can be made any time and it takes a week to make from stored grain. So it's a really, really different kind of product.
That's really good. Do you want to share any other findings from your excavation about wine production?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the winery that we uncovered at Jezreel is very interesting for a number of reasons. But one of the things that kind of relates to what we were talking about before is that it's located on the kind of the slopes of the northern part of Tel Jezreel. And it includes a treading floor as well as a few vats. Also, it has a number of these deep bedrock mortars that are cut into the limestone bedrock. And so they're similar to the mortars we were talking about before that were used to apparently brew Natufian beer from wild wheat and barley. And it's hard to date these things because, I mean, thousands and thousands of these rock cut mortars are known from limestone outcrops all over Israel. Sometimes they're found in good archaeological contexts and you can actually excavate them and get, like at Rakhefet Cave, to the residues of their original use. But in the case of the ones from Jezreel, they've been exposed for a long time. And so they filled up with trash and other, you know, kind of wash and things like this. So it's hard to date them, but they're similar in shape. So I think what we've got here is probably an agricultural production area, kind of multi-use, that may have been used to process and kind of de-husk grains in preparation for making beer some time of the year. And then it was used also to make wine during that narrow window, September, October, when wine production was happening. And then it also could have been used for processing other foodstuffs at other times of year, and also may have been used over the course of literally thousands of years. So that's something that really interests me about this discovery, is that it's not just, you know, a treading floor in a vat. It's like a whole kind of surface that, you know, was sort of a multi-use agricultural production area that, you know, seems to have been used for many, many generations, actually. So that's really fun, you know, having sort of the, you know, superimposed almost, you know, kind of different ages, I guess, of wine and beer production in one specific area. And since it was located really close to where the vineyards would have been, it was probably in the middle of the vineyard. It's very close to the agricultural terrace that's still being planted today. Then it makes sense that this would have been an area that would have been convenient for the various communities that lived at Jezreel in the past to use to make wine and beer and, you know, lots of other things probably.
Wow. That's really cool to hear that juxtaposition, the contrast of beer production, wine production.
Yeah.
Wow. That's really great. If you want to share anything that didn't make it into the article, like, you know, deleted scenes, I don't know if you...
Deleted scenes from the article. Yeah. I mean, you know, I think we've both done a lot more research since we wrote that article and gave that conference presentation. So, you know, I'm working on some research now that's kind of trying to bring together and incorporate some of the more recent discoveries, especially the ones, you know, pre-Neolithic, you know, kind of discoveries of bread making and beer making in the region, which I find really interesting. And these are only possible because of the kind of new kinds of sampling techniques that are characterizing archaeology in the region. The fact that people are looking for these things in a way that, you know, a couple of decades ago, we just were missing it entirely with our focus on pottery and architecture and kind of the, you know, kind of the usual things that archaeologists had been looking for. So, I mean, I find that really, a real positive development, you know, that we've got archaeologists from prehistorians through the biblical period, through the classical period, through, you know, more recent times, who are really focused on looking at ancient food and drink residues in a way that they've never before. So I think there's a lot that we're gonna know in the next few years coming out of this research that's gonna really change our understanding of these things in ancient Israel. So it's pretty exciting. I mean, there are things, you know, that we know now that we just didn't even know then when we were writing this article.
Really? That was just a decade and a half.
Yeah. So I mean, I think there's been so much attention on, you know, especially relative to Israel. I mean, beer production in Egypt and, you know, kind of other Egyptian sources for alcohol in the pharaonic period. And, you know, people were kind of lamenting there's really not much we're ever really going to know about things like beer production in Israel, because we just don't have the physical evidence. It just doesn't, it doesn't last and, you know, kind of sink into the vessels and form these kind of residues that wine does, you know. So, but now, I mean, with new techniques for identifying, for example, yeast, as well as, you know, fermented grains generally in vessels and also in ovens, I mean, I think we're going to have a much better understanding of these kind of activities, especially in houses, you know, and not in more specialized kind of, you know, areas like factories or, you know, kind of larger commercial production areas. And so this is going to really help us give us a better understanding of everyday life. Yeah. Which is what a lot of archaeologists are allegedly interested in, is like, you know, what were people doing in their everyday lives, and not just kind of looking at political history and sort of the kind of big picture topics, you know? So, yeah. So I'm filled with hope about the future of food and drink technology and our understanding of it in antiquity.
Wow. That's really awesome. Thank you.
Yeah, sure.
Hey right. there. Hope you've been enjoying this archaeologically based episode for JewishDream.com. Here is a sneak peek into next week's also archaeologically related episode.
You know, every bar has food. And I think you have to imagine that when there's drinking going on, there's also eating very often as well, or eating something.
Yeah.
Right? So what we're really talking about is feasting.
All right. Professor Ebling, thank you so much for coming on to the show today. This was really great, informative, definitely great to see more stuff beyond just what was in the article and your research. And I'm also excited for that article coming out.
All right. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. All right. Thank you.